18. "Jesus," Eddie said. "What kind of people are these guys?" They had followed the avenue at the base of the ramp for a couple of blocks, had seen the barricade, missing Roland's entry into the partially hidden passageway by less than a minute, which lay ahead, and had turned north onto a broad thoroughfare which reminded Eddie of Fifth Avenue. He hadn't dared to tell Susanna that. He was still too bitterly disappointed with this stinking, littered ruin of a city to articulate anything hopeful. Fifth Avenue led them into an area of large white stone buildings that reminded Eddie of the way Rome looked in the gladiator movies he'd watched on TV as a kid. They were austere and, for the most part, still in good shape. He was pretty sure they had been public buildings of some sort, galleries, libraries, maybe museums. One, with a big domed roof that had cracked like a granite egg, might have been an observatory. Although Eddie had read someplace that astronomers like to be away from big cities, because all the electric lights fucked up their stargazing. There were open areas between these imposing edifices, and although the grass and flowers which had once grown there had been choked off by weeds and tangles of underbrush, the area still had a stately feel, and Eddie wondered if it had once been the center of Ludd's cultural life. Those days were long gone, of course. Eddie doubted if Gasher and his pals were very interested in ballet or chamber music. He and Susanna had come to a major intersection from which four more broad avenues radiated outward like spokes on a wheel. At the hub of the wheel was a large paved square. Ringing it were loudspeakers on 40-foot steel posts. In the center of the square was a pedestal with the remains of a statue upon it, a mighty copper warhorse, green with verdigris, pawing its forelegs at the air. The warrior who had once ridden this charger lay off to the side on one corroded shoulder, waving what looked like a machine gun in one hand and a sword in the other. His legs were still bowed around the shape of the horse he had once ridden, but his boots remained welded to the sides of his metal mount. "Gray's Die" was written across the pedestal in fading orange letters. Glancing down the radiating streets, Eddie saw more of the speaker poles. A few had fallen over, but most still stood, and each of these had been festooned with a grisly garland of corpses. As a result, the square into which Fifth Avenue emptied and the streets which led away were guarded by a small army of the dead. "What kind of people are they?" Eddie asked again. He didn't expect an answer, and Susanna didn't give one. But she could have. She'd had insights into the past of Roland's world before, but never one as clear and sure as this. All of her earlier insights, like those which had come to her in River Crossing, had had a haunting, visionary quality, like dreams. But what came now arrived in a single flash, and it was like seeing the twisted face of a dangerous maniac illuminated by a stroke of lightning. The speakers, the hanging bodies, the drums. She suddenly understood how they went together, as clearly as she had understood that the heavy-laden wagons passing through River Crossing on their way to Jimtown had been pulled by oxen rather than mules or horses. "Never mind this trash," she said, and her voice only quivered a little. "It's a train we want. Which way is it, do you think?" Eddie glanced up at the darkening sky and easily picked out the path of the beam in the rushing clouds. He looked back down, and wasn't much surprised to see that the entrance to the street corresponding most closely to the path of the beam was guarded by a large stone turtle. Its reptilian head peered out from beneath the granite lip of its shell. Its deep-set eyes seemed to stare curiously at them. Eddie nodded toward it and managed a small, dry smile. "See the turtle of enormous girth?" Susanna took a brief look of her own and nodded. He pushed her across the city square and into the street of the turtle. The corpses which lined it gave off a dry, cinnamony smell that made Eddie's stomach clench, not because it was bad, but because it was actually rather pleasant, the sugar-spicy aroma of something a kid would enjoy shaking onto his morning toast. The street of the turtle was mercifully broad, and most of the corpses hanging from the speaker poles were little more than mummies, But Susanna saw a few which were relatively fresh, with flies still crawling busily across the blackening skin of their swollen faces and maggots still squirming out of their decaying eyes. And below each speaker was a little drift of bones. "There must be thousands," Eddie said. "Men, women, and kids." "Yes." Susanna's calm voice sounded distant and strange to her own ears. "They've had a lot of time to kill, and they've used it to kill each other." "Bring on those wise fucking elves," Eddie said, and the laugh that followed sounded suspiciously like a sob. He thought he was at last beginning to fully understand what that innocuous phrase, "the world has moved on," really meant. What a breadth of ignorance and evil it covered. And what a depth. The speakers were a wartime measure, Susanna thought. Of course they were. God only knows which war, or how long ago, but it must have been a doozy. The rulers of Lud used the speakers to make city-wide announcements from some central bomb-proof location, a bunker, like the one Hitler and his high command retreated to at the end of World War II. And in her ears she could hear the voice of authority which had come rolling out of those speakers, could hear it as clearly as she had heard the creak of the wagons passing through River Crossing, as clearly as she had heard the crack of the whip above the backs of the straining oxen. "Ration centers A and D will be closed today. Please proceed to centers B, C, E, and F with proper coupons. Militia squads 9, 10, and 12 report to send side. Aerial bombardment is likely between the hours of 8 and 10 of the clock. All non-combatant residents should report to their designated shelters. Bring your gas masks. Repeat, bring your gas masks."
Announcements, yes. And some garbled version of the news. A propagandized, militant version George Orwell would have called doublespeak. And in between the news bulletins and the announcements, squalling military music, and exhortations to respect the fallen by sending more men and women into the red throat of the abattoir. Then the war had ended, and silence had fallen for a while. But at some point, the speakers had begun broadcasting again. How long ago? 100 years? 50? Did it matter? Susanna thought not. What mattered was that when the speakers were reactivated, the only thing they broadcast was a single tape loop, the loop with the drum track on it. And the descendants of the city's original residents had taken it for... what? The voice of the turtle? The will of the beam? Susanna found herself remembering the time she had asked her father, a quiet but deeply cynical man, if he believed there was a God in heaven who guided the course of human events. "Well," he had said, "I think it's sort of half and half, Odetta. I'm sure there's a God, but I don't think he has much, if anything, to do with us these days. I believe that after we kill his son, he finally got it through his head that there wasn't nothing to be done with the sons of Adam or the daughters of Eve, and he washed his hands of us. Wise fella." She had responded to this, which she had fully expected. She was 11 at the time, and knew the turn of her father's mind quite well, by showing him a squib on the community church's page of the local newspaper. It said that Reverend Murdoch of the Grace Methodist Church would that Sunday elucidate on the topic, "God speaks to each of us every day," with a text from 1 Corinthians. Her father had laughed over that so hard that tears had squirted from the corners of his eyes. "Well, I guess each of us hears someone talking," he had said at last. "And you can bet your bottom dollar on one thing, sweetie. Each of us, including this here Reverend Murdoch, hears that voice say just exactly what he wants to hear. It's so convenient that way." What these people had apparently wanted to hear in the recorded drum track was an invitation to commit ritual murder. And now, when the drums began to throb through these hundreds or thousands of speakers, a hammering backbeat which was only the percussion to a ZZ Top song called Velcro Fly, if Eddie was right, it became their signal to unlimber the hang ropes and run a few folks up the nearest speaker posts. "How many?" she wondered, as Eddie rolled her along in her wheelchair, its nicked and dented hard rubber tires crackling over broken glass and whispering through drifts of discarded paper. "How many have been killed over the years because some electronic circuit under the city got the hiccups?" Did it start because they recognized the essential alienness of the music, which came somehow, like us and the airplane and some of the cars along these streets, from another world? She didn't know, but she knew she had come around to her father's cynical point of view on the subject of God and the chats he might or might not have with the sons of Adam and the daughters of Eve. These people had been looking for a reason to slaughter each other, that was all, and the drums had been as good a reason as any. She found herself thinking of the hive they had found, the misshapen hive of white bees whose honey would have poisoned them if they had been foolish enough to eat of it. Here, on this side of the Send, was another dying hive, more mutated white bees, whose sting would be no less deadly for their confusion, loss, and perplexity. And how many more will have to die before the tape finally breaks? As if her thoughts had caused it to happen, the speakers suddenly began to transmit the relentless, syncopated heartbeat of the drums. Eddie yelled in surprise. Susanna screamed and clapped both hands to her ears. But before she did, she could faintly hear the rest of the music, the track or tracks which had been muted decades ago when someone, probably quite by accident, had bumped the balance control, knocking it all the way to one side and burying both the guitars and the vocal. Eddie continued to push her along the street of the turtle and the path of the beam, trying to look in all directions at once and trying not to smell the odor of putrefaction. Thank God for the wind, he thought. He began to push the wheelchair faster, scanning the weedy gaps between the big white buildings for the graceful sweep of an overhead monorail track. He wanted to get out of this endless aisle of the dead. As he took yet another deep breath of that speciously sweet cinnamon smell, it seemed to him that he had never wanted anything so badly in his whole life. 19. Jake's daze was broken abruptly when Gasher grabbed him by the collar and yanked with all the force of a cruel rider breaking a galloping horse. He stuck one leg out at the same time, and Jake went crashing backward over it. His head connected with the pavement, and for a moment all the lights went out. Gasher, no humanitarian, brought him around quickly by seizing Jake's lower lip and yanking it upward and outward. Jake screamed and bolted to a sitting position, striking out blindly with his fists. Gasher dodged the blows easily, hooked his other hand into Jake's armpit, and yanked him to his feet. Jake stood there, rocking drunkenly back and forth. He was beyond protest now, almost beyond understanding. All he knew for sure was that every muscle in his body felt sprung, and his wounded hand was howling like an animal caught in a trap. Gasher apparently needed a breather, and this time he was slower getting his wind back. He stood bent over with his hands planted on the knees of his green trousers, panting in fast little whistling breaths. His yellow headscarf had slipped askew. His good eye glittered like a trumpery diamond. The white silk eye patch was now wrinkled, and curds of evil-looking yellow muck oozed onto his cheek from beneath it.
"Take a look over your head, Kelly, and you'll see why I brung you up short. Get an eyeful."
Jake tilted his head upward, and in the depths of his shock he was not at all surprised to see a marble fountain as big as a house trailer dangling 80 feet above them. He and Gasher were almost below it. The fountain was held suspended by two rusty cables, which were mostly hidden within huge, unsteady stacks of church pews. Even in his less than acute state, Jake saw that these cables were more seriously frayed than the remaining hangers on the bridge had been.
"See it?" Gasher asked, grinning.
He raised his left hand to his covered eye, scooped a mass of the pussy material from beneath it, and flicked it indifferently aside.
"Beauty, ain't it? Oh, the TikTok man's a trig cove, all right, no mistake. Where's those goat-fucking drums? They should have started by now. If Copperhead's forgotten, I'll ram a stick so far up his arse he'll taste bark. Now, look ahead of you, my delicious little squint."
Jake did, and Gasher immediately clouted him so hard that he staggered backward and almost fell.
"Not across, idiot child. Down. See them two dark cobblestones?"
After a moment, Jake did. He nodded apathetically.
"You don't want to step on him. For that, it'd bring the whole works down on your head, Kelly, and anybody who wanted you after that, he'd have to pick you up with a blotter. Understand?"
Jake nodded again.
"Good."
Gasher took a final deep breath and slapped Jake's shoulder.
"Go on, then. What you waiting for? Up!"
Jake stepped over the first of the discolored stones and saw it wasn't really a cobblestone at all, but a metal plate which had been rounded to look like one. The second was just ahead of it, cunningly placed so that if an unaware intruder happened to miss the first one, he or she would almost certainly step on the second.
"Go ahead and do it, then," he thought. "Why not? The gunslinger's never going to find you in this maze, so go ahead and bring it down. It's got to be cleaner than what Gasher and his friends have got planned for you. Quicker, too."
His dusty moccasin wavered in the air above the booby trap. Gasher hit him with a fist in the middle of the back, but not hard.
"Thinking about taking a ride on the Handsome, are you, my little cow?" he asked.
The laughing cruelty in his voice had been replaced by simple curiosity. If it was tinged with any other emotion, it wasn't fear, but amusement.
"Well, go ahead, if that's what you mean to do, for I have my ticket already. Only be quick about it, God's blast your eyes."
Jake's foot came down beyond the trigger of the booby trap. His decision to live a little longer was not based on any hope that Roland would find him. It was just that this was what Roland would do. Go on until someone made him stop, and then a few yards farther still if he could. If he did it now, he could take Gasher with him, but Gasher alone wasn't sufficient. One look was enough to make it clear that he was telling the truth when he said he was dying already. If he went on, he might have a chance to take some of the Gasher man's friends, too, maybe even the one he called the Tick-Tock Man. "If I'm going to ride what he calls the Handsome," Jake thought, "I'd just as soon go with plenty of company." Roland would have understood. 20. Jake was wrong in his assessment of the gunslinger's ability to follow their path through the maze. Jake's pack was only the most obvious bit of sign they left behind them. But Roland quickly realized he did not have to pause to look for sign. He only had to follow Oi. He paused at several intersecting passages nevertheless, wanting to make sure. And each time he did, Oi looked back and uttered his low, impatient bark that seemed to say, "Hurry up, do you want to lose them?" After the signs he saw, a track, a thread from Jake's shirt, a scrap of bright yellow cloth from Gasher's scarf, had three times confirmed the bumbler's choices, Roland simply followed Oi. He did not give up looking for sign, but he quit making stops to hunt for it. Then the drums started up, and it was the drums, plus Gasher's nosiness about what Jake might be carrying, that saved Roland's life that afternoon. He skidded to a halt in his dusty boots, and his gun was in his hand before he realized what the sound was. When he did realize, he dropped the revolver back into its holster with an impatient grunt. He was about to go on again when his eye happened first on Jake's pack, and then on a pair of faint, gleaming streaks in midair just to the left of it. Roland narrowed his eyes and made out two thin wires which crisscrossed at knee level not 3 feet in front of him. Oi, who was built low to the ground, had scurried neatly through the inverted V formed by the wires, but if not for the drums and spotting Jake's cast-off pack, Roland would have run right into them. As his eyes moved upward, tracing the not-quite-random piles of junk poised on either side of the passageway at this point, Roland's mouth tightened. It had been a close call, and only Kaa had saved him. Oi barked impatiently. Roland dropped to his belly and crawled beneath the wires, moving slowly and carefully. He was bigger than either Jake or Gasher, and he realized a really big man wouldn't be able to get under here at all without triggering the carefully prepared avalanche. The drums pumped and thumped in his ears. "I wonder if they've all gone mad," he thought. "If I had to listen to that every day, I think I would have." He got to the far side of the wires, picked up the pack, and looked inside. Jake's books and a few items of clothing were still in there. So were the treasures he had picked up along the way, a rock which gleamed with yellow flecks that looked like gold but weren't, an arrowhead, probably the leaving of the old forest folk, which Jake had found in a grove of trees the day after his drawing, some coins from his own world, his father's sunglasses, a few other things which only a boy not yet in his teens could really love and understand. Things he would want back again. If, that was, Roland got to him before Gasher and his friends could change him, hurt him in ways that would cause him to lose interest in the innocent pursuits and curiosities of pre-adolescent boyhood. Gasher's grinning face swam into Roland's mind like the face of a demon or a genie from a bottle. The snaggled teeth, the vacant eyes, the mandrus crawling over the cheeks and spreading beneath the stubbly lines of the jaws. "If you hurt him," he thought, and then forced his mind away, because that line of thought was a blind alley. If Gasher hurt the boy, Jake, his mind insisted fiercely, not just the boy, but Jake, Jake! Roland would kill him, yes. But the act would mean nothing, for Gasher was a dead man already. The gunslinger lengthened the straps of the pack, marveling at the clever buckles which made this possible, slipped it onto his own back, and stood up again. Oi turned to be off, but Roland called his name, and the bumbler looked back. "To me, Oi." Roland didn't know if the bumbler could understand, or if he would obey even if he did, but it would be better, safer, if he stayed close. Where there was one booby trap, there were apt to be more. Next time, Oi might not be so lucky.
"Ake!"
Oi barked, not moving. The bark was assertive, but Roland thought he saw more of the truth about how Oi felt in his eyes. They were dark with fear. "Yes, but it's dangerous," Roland said. "To me, Oi." Back the way they had come, there was a thud, as something heavy fell, probably dislodged by the punishing vibration of the drums. Roland could now see speaker poles here and there, poking out of the wreckage like strange, long-necked animals. Oi trotted back to him and looked up, panting. "Stay close."
"Jake! Jake, Jake!"
"Yes, Jake." He began to run again, and Oi ran beside him. 21. For Eddie, it was, as some wise man had once said, deja vu all over again. He was running with the wheelchair, racing time. The beach had been replaced by the Street of the Turtle, but somehow everything else was the same. Well, there was one other relevant difference. Now it was a railway station, or a cradle, he was looking for, not a freestanding door. Susanna was sitting bolt upright, with her hair blowing out behind her and Roland's revolver in her right hand, its barrel pointed up at the cloudy, troubled sky. The drums thudded and pounded, bludgeoning them with sound. A gigantic, dish-shaped object lay in the street just ahead, and Eddie's overstrained mind, perhaps cued by the classical buildings on either side of them, produced an image of Jove and Thor playing frisbee. Jove throws one wide, and Thor lets it fall through a cloud. What the hell, it's Miller time on Olympus anyway. Frisbees of the gods, he thought, swerving Susanna between two crumbling, rusty cars. What a concept. He bumped the chair up on the sidewalk to get around the artifact, which looked like some sort of telecommunications dish now that he was really close to it. He was easing the wheelchair over the curb and back into the street again. The sidewalk was too littered with crap to make any real time when the drums suddenly cut out. The echoes rolled away into a new silence, except it wasn't really silent at all, Eddie realized. Up ahead, the arched entrance to a marble building stood at the intersection of the Street of the Turtle and another avenue. This building had been overgrown by vines and some straggly green stuff that looked like cypress beards, but it was still magnificent and somehow dignified. Beyond it, around the corner, a crowd was babbling excitedly. "Don't stop," Susanna snapped. "We haven't got time to—" A hysterical shriek drilled through the babble. It was accompanied by yells of approval and, incredibly, the sort of applause Eddie had heard in Atlantic City hotel casinos after some lounge act had finished doing its thing. The shriek was choked into a long, dying gargle that sounded like the buzz of a cicada. Eddie felt the hair on the nape of his neck coming to attention. He glanced at the corpses hanging from the nearest speaker pole and understood that the fun-loving pubes of Ludd were holding another public execution. Marvelous, he thought. Now if they only had Tony Orlando and Dawn to sing Knock three times, they could all die happy. Eddie looked curiously at the stone pile on the corner. This close, the vines which overgrew it had a powerful herbal smell. That smell was eye-wateringly bitter, but he still liked it better than the cinnamon-sweet odor of the mummified corpses. The beards of greenery growing from the vines drooped in ratty sheaves, creating waterfalls of vegetation where once there had been a series of arched entrances. A figure suddenly barreled out through one of these waterfalls and hurried toward them. It was a kid, Eddie realized, and not that many years out of diapers, judging by the size. He was wearing a weird little Lord Fauntleroy outfit, complete with ruffled white shirt and velveteen short pants. There were ribbons in his hair. Eddie felt a sudden mad urge to wave his hands above his head and scream, "But we'd say Lud is O-tay!" "Come on!" the kid cried in a high, piping voice. Several sprays of the green stuff had gotten caught in his hair. He brushed absently at these with his left hand as he ran.
"They're gonna do spankers! It's the spanker man's turn to go to the land of the drums! Come on, or you'll miss the whole fakement, gods cuss it!"
Susanna was equally stunned by the child's appearance, but as he got closer, it struck her that there was something extremely odd and awkward about the way he was brushing at the crumbles and strands of greenery which had gotten caught in his beribboned hair. He kept using just that one hand. His other had been behind his back when he ran out through the weedy waterfall, and there it remained. How awkward that must be, she thought. And then a tape player turned on in her mind, and she heard Roland speaking at the end of the bridge. "I knew something like this could happen. If we'd seen the fellow earlier, while we were still beyond the range of his exploding egg, damn the luck!" She leveled Roland's gun at the child, who had leaped from the curb and was running straight for them. "Hold it!" she screamed. "Stand still, you!" "Suze, what are you doing?" Eddie yelled. Susanna ignored him. In a very real sense, Susanna Dean was no longer even here. It was Detta Walker in the chair now, and her eyes were glittering with feverish suspicion.
"Stop or I'll shoot!"
Little Lord Fauntleroy might have been deaf for all the effector warning had.
"House it!" he shouted jubilantly. "You're going to miss the whole show! Spanker's going to—"
His right hand finally began to come out from behind his back. As it did, Eddie realized they weren't looking at a kid but at a misshapen dwarf whose childhood was many years past. The expression Eddie had at first taken for childish glee was actually a chilly mixture of hate and rage. The dwarf's cheeks and brow were covered with the oozing, discolored patches Roland called "whore's blossoms." Susanna never saw his face. Her attention was fixed on the emerging right hand and the dull green sphere it held. That was all she needed to see. Roland's gun crashed. The dwarf was hammered backward. A shrill cry of pain and rage rose from his tiny mouth as he landed on the sidewalk. The grenade bounced out of his hand and rolled back into the same arch through which he had emerged. Detta was gone, like a dream, and Susanna looked from the smoking gun to the tiny, sprawled figure on the sidewalk with surprise, horror, and dismay.
"Oh, my Jesus! I shot him! Eddie, I shot him!"
"Graze die!"
Little Lord Fauntleroy tried to scream these words defiantly, but they came out in a bubbling choke of blood that drenched the few remaining white patches on his frilly shirt. There was a muffled explosion from inside the overgrown plaza of the corner building, and the shaggy carpets of green stuff hanging in front of the arches billowed outward like flags in a brisk gale. With them came clouds of choking, acrid smoke. Eddie flung himself on top of Susanna to shield her and felt a gritty shower of concrete fragments, all small ones, luckily, patter down on his back, his neck, and the crown of his head. There was a series of unpleasantly wet smacking sounds to his left. He opened his eyes a crack, looked in that direction, and saw little Lord Fauntleroy's head just coming to a stop in the gutter. The dwarf's eyes were still open, his mouth still fixed in its final snarl. Now there were other voices, some shrieking, some yelling, all furious. Eddie rolled off Susanna's chair, it tottered on one wheel before deciding to stay up, and stared in the direction from which the dwarf had come. A ragged mob of about 20 men and women had appeared, some coming from around the corner, others pushing through the mats of foliage which obscured the corner building's arches, materializing from the smoke of the dwarf's grenade like evil spirits. Most were wearing blue headscarves, and all were carrying weapons, a varied and somehow pitiful assortment of them, which included rusty swords, dull knives, and splintery clubs. Eddie saw one man defiantly waving a hammer. "Pubes," Eddie thought. "We interrupted their necktie party, and they're pissed as hell about it." A tangle of shouts, "Kill the Greys! Kill them both! They've done for Lester! God kill their eyes!" arose from this charming group as they caught sight of Susanna in her wheelchair and Eddie, who was now crouched on one knee before it. The man in the forefront was wearing a kilt-like wrap and waving a cutlass. He brandished this wildly. He would have decapitated the heavy-set woman standing close behind him had she not ducked, and then charged. The others followed, yelling happily. Roland's gun pounded its bright thunder into the windy, overcast day, and the top of the kilt-wearing pube's head lifted off. The sallow skin of the woman who had almost been decapitated by his cutlass was suddenly stippled with red rain, and she voiced a sound of barking dismay. The others came on past the woman and the dead man, raving and wild-eyed.
"Eddie!" Susanna screamed and fired again. A man wearing a silk-lined cape and knee boots collapsed into the street.
Eddie groped for the Ruger and had one panicky moment when he thought he had lost it. The butt of the gun had somehow slipped down inside the waistband of his pants. He wrapped his hand around it and yanked hard. The fucking thing wouldn't come. The sight at the end of the barrel had somehow gotten stuck in his underwear. Susanna fired three closely spaced shots. Each found a target, but the oncoming pubes didn't slow.
"Eddie, help me!"
Eddie tore his pants open, feeling like some cut-rate version of Superman, and finally managed to free the Ruger. He hit the safety with the heel of his left palm, placed his elbow on his leg just above the knee, and began to fire. There was no need to think, no need to even aim. Roland had told them that in battle a gunslinger's hands worked on their own, and Eddie now discovered it was true. It would have been hard for a blind man to miss at this range anyway. Susanna had cut the numbers of the charging pubes to no more than 15. Eddie went through the remainder like a storm wind in a wheat field, dropping 4 in less than 2 seconds. Now the single face of the mob, that look of glazed and mindless eagerness, began to break apart. The man with the hammer abruptly tossed his weapon aside and ran for it, limping extravagantly on a pair of arthritis-twisted legs. He was followed by 2 others. The rest of them milled uncertainly in the street.
"Come on, you deuces!"
a relatively young man snarled. He wore his blue scarf around his throat like a rally racer's ascot. He was bald except for 2 fluffs of frizzy red hair, one on each side of his head. To Susanna, this fellow looked like Clarabelle the Clown. To Eddie, he looked like Ronald McDonald. To both of them, he looked like trouble. He threw a homemade spear that might have started life as a steel table leg. It clattered harmlessly into the street to Eddie and Susanna's right.
"Come on, I say! We can get him if we all stick together!"
"Sorry, guy," Eddie murmured, and shot him in the chest. Clarabelle Ronald staggered backward, one hand going to his shirt. He stared at Eddie with huge eyes that told his tale with heartbreaking clarity. This wasn't supposed to happen. The hand dropped heavily to the young man's side. A single runlet of blood, incredibly bright in the gray day, slipped from the corner of his mouth. The few remaining pubes stared at him mutely as he slipped to his knees, and one of them turned to run.
"Not at all," Eddie said. "Stay put, my retarded friend, or you're going to get a good look at the clearing where your path ends."
He raised his voice. "Drop 'em, boys and girls, all of 'em, now!"
"You," the dying man whispered, "you gunslinger?"
"That's right," Eddie said. His eyes surveyed the remaining pubes grimly.
"Cry your pardon,"
the man with the frizzy red hair gasped, and then he fell forward onto his face.
"Gunslingers?"
one of the others asked. His tone was one of dawning horror and realization.
"Well, you're stupid, but you ain't deaf," Susanna said, "and that's something anyway."
She waggled the barrel of the gun, which Eddie was quite sure was empty. For that matter, how many rounds could be left in the Ruger? He realized he didn't have any idea how many rounds the clip held, and cursed himself for a fool. But had he really believed it could come to something like this? He didn't think so.
"You heard him, folks. Drop 'em. Recess is over."
One by one, they complied. The woman who was wearing a pint or so of Mr. Sword and Kilt's blood on her face said,
"You shouldn't have killed Winston, missus. 'Twas his birthday, so it was."
"Well, I guess he should have stayed home and eaten some more birthday cake," Eddie said.
Given the overall quality of this experience, he didn't find either the woman's comment or his own response at all surreal. There was one other woman among the remaining pubes, a scrawny thing whose long blonde hair was coming out in big patches as if she had the mange. Eddie observed her sidling toward the dead dwarf and the potential safety of the overgrown arches beyond him, and put a bullet into the cracked cement close by her foot. He had no idea what he wanted with her, but what he didn't want was one of them giving the rest of them ideas. For one thing, he was afraid of what his hands might do if the sickly, sullen people before him tried to run. Whatever his head thought about this gunslinging business, his hands had discovered they liked it just fine. "Stand where you are, beautiful. Officer Friendly says play it safe." He glanced at Susanna and was disturbed by the grayish quality of her complexion. "Suze, you all right?" he asked in a lower voice. "Yes." "You're not going to faint or anything, are you? Because no." She looked at him with eyes so dark they were like caves. "It's just that I never shot anyone before, okay?" "Well, you better get used to it," rose to his lips. He bit it back and returned his gaze to the five people who remained before them. They were looking at him and Susanna with a species of sullen fear, which nevertheless stopped well short of terror. "Shit, most of 'em have forgotten what terror is," he thought. "Joy, sadness, love, same thing. I don't think they feel much of anything anymore. They've been living in this purgatory too long." Then he remembered the laughter, the excited cries, the lounge-act applause, and revised his thinking. There was at least one thing that still got their motors running, one thing that still pushed their buttons. Spanker could have testified to that. "Who's in charge here?" Eddie asked. He was watching the intersection behind the little group very carefully in case the others should get their courage back. So far, he saw and heard nothing alarming from that direction. He thought that the others had probably left this ragged crew to its fate. They looked at each other uncertainly, and finally the woman with the blood-spattered face spoke up.
"Spanker was, but when the guy drum started up this time, it was Spanker's stone what come out of the hat, and we set him to dance. I guess Winston would come next, but you did for him with your god-rotted guns, so you did."
She wiped blood deliberately from her cheek, looked at it, and then returned her sullen glance to Eddie. "Well, what do you think Winston was trying to do to me with his god-rotted spear?" Eddie asked. He was disgusted to find the woman had actually made him feel guilty about what he had done. "Trim my sideburns?"
"Killed Frank and Luster, too," she went on doggedly. "And what are you, either grays, which is bad, or a couple of god-rotted outlanders, which is worse? Who's left for the pubes in City North? Topsy, I suppose. Topsy the sailor, but he ain't here, is he? Took his boat and went off down river, eh? So he did, and God rot him, too," says I.
Susanna had ceased listening. Her mind had fixed with horrified fascination on something the woman had said earlier. It was Spanker's stone what come out of the hat, and we set him to dance. She remembered reading Shirley Jackson's story, The Lottery, in college, and understood that these people, the degenerate descendants of the original pubes, were living Jackson's nightmare. No wonder they weren't capable of any strong emotion when they knew they would have to participate in such a grisly drawing not once a year, as in the story, but two or three times each day. "Why?" she asked the bloody woman in a harsh, horrified voice. "Why do you do it?" The woman looked at Susanna as if she was the world's biggest fool.
"Why? Well, so the ghosts what live in the machines won't take over the bodies of those who have died here, pubes and grays alike, and send them up through the holes in the streets to eat us. Any fool knows that."
"There are no such things as ghosts," Susanna said. And her voice sounded like so much meaningless quacking to her own ears. Of course there were. In this world there were ghosts everywhere. Nevertheless, she pushed ahead.
"What you call the God drums is only a tape stuck in a machine. That's really all it is."
Sudden inspiration struck her, and she added, "Oh, maybe the Greys are doing it on purpose. Did you ever think of that? They live in the other part of the city, don't they? And under it as well? They've always wanted you out. Maybe they've just hit on a really efficient way of getting you guys to do their work for them." The bloody woman was standing next to an elderly gent wearing what looked like the world's oldest bowler hat and a pair of frayed khaki shorts. Now he stepped forward and spoke to her with a patina of good manners that turned his underlying contempt into a dagger with razor-sharp edges.
You are quite wrong, Madam Gunslinger. There are a great many machines under Ludd, and there are ghosts in all of them, demonous spirits which bear only ill will to mortal men and women. These demon ghosts are very capable of raising the dead, and in Ludd there are a great many dead to raise.
Listen, Eddie said, have you ever seen one of these zombies with your own eyes, Jeeves? Have any of you? Jeeves curled his lip and said nothing. But that lip curl really said it all. What else could one expect, it asked, from outlanders who used guns as a substitute for understanding. Eddie decided it would be best to close off the whole line of discussion. He had never been cut out for missionary work anyway. He waggled the Ruger at the blood-stained woman. You and your friend there, the one who looks like an English butler on his day off, are going to take us to the railroad station. After that, we can all say goodbye. And I'll tell you the truth, that's going to make my fucking day.
Railroad station? The guy who looked like Jeeves the butler asked. What is a railroad station?
Take us to the cradle, Susanna said. Take us to Blaine.
This finally rattled Jeeves. An expression of shocked horror replaced the world-weary contempt with which he had thus far treated them.
You can't go there, he cried. The cradle is forbidden ground, and Blaine is the most dangerous of all Ludd's ghosts.
Forbidden ground, Eddie thought. Great. If it's a truth, at least we'll be able to stop worrying about you assholes. It was also nice to hear that there still was a Blaine, or that these people thought there was, anyway. The others were staring at Eddie and Susanna with expressions of uncomprehending amazement. It was as if the interlopers had suggested to a bunch of born-again Christians that they hunt up the Ark of the Covenant and turn it into a pay toilet. Eddie raised the Ruger until the center of Jeeves' forehead lay in the sight.
We're going, he said. And if you don't want to join your ancestors right here and now, I suggest you stop pissing and moaning and take us there.
Jeeves and the blood-stained woman exchanged an uncertain glance, but when the man in the bowler hat looked back at Eddie and Susanna, his face was firm and set.
Shoot us if you like, he said. We'd sooner die here than there.
You folks are a bunch of sick motherfuckers with dying on the brain, Susanna cried at them. Nobody has to die. Just take us where we want to go, for the love of God.
The woman said somberly,
But it is death to enter Blaine's cradle, Mum, so it is, for Blaine sleeps, and he who disturbs his rest must pay a high price.
Come on, beautiful, Eddie snapped. You can't smell the coffee with your head up your ass.
I don't know what that means,
she said with an odd and perplexing dignity.
It means you can take us to the cradle and risk the wrath of Blaine, or you can stand your ground here and experience the wrath of Eddie. It doesn't have to be a nice clean headshot, you know. I can take you a piece at a time, and I'm feeling just mean enough to do it. I'm having a very bad day in your city. The music sucks, everybody has a bad case of B.O., and the first guy we saw threw a grenade at us and kidnapped our friend. So what do you say?
Why would you go to Blaine in any case? One of the others asked. He stirs no more from his birth in the cradle, not for years now. He has even stopped speaking in his many voices and laughing.
Speaking in his many voices and laughing, Eddie thought. He looked at Susanna. She looked back and shrugged.
Ardis was the last to go nigh Blaine, the blood-stained woman said.
Jeeves nodded somberly.
Ardis always was a fool when he were in drink. Blaine asked him some question. I heard it, but it made no sense to me, something about the mother of ravens, I think. And when Ardis couldn't answer what was asked, Blaine slew him with blue fire.
Electricity? Eddie asked. Jeeves and the blood-stained woman both nodded.
Aye, the woman said. Electricity. So it were called in the old days, so it were.
You don't have to go in with us, Susanna proposed suddenly. Just get us within sight of the place. We'll go the rest of the way on our own. The woman looked at her mistrustfully, and then Jeeves pulled her head close to his lips and mumbled in her ear for a while. The other pubes stood behind them in a ragged line, looking at Eddie and Susanna with the dazed eyes of people who have survived a bad air raid. At last the woman looked around.
"Aye," she said, "we'll take you nigh the cradle, and then it's good riddance to Bad Swill."
"My idea exactly," Eddie said. "You and Jeeves, the rest of you scatter." He swept them with his eyes. "But remember this. One spear thrown from ambush, one arrow, one brick, and these two die." This threat came out sounding so weak and pointless that Eddie wished he hadn't made it. How could they possibly care for these two, or for any of the individual members of their clan, when they dusted two or more of them each and every day? Well, he thought, watching the others trot off without so much as a backward glance, it was too late to worry about that now.
"Come on," the woman said. "I want to be done with you."
"The feeling's mutual," Eddie replied. But before she and Jeeves led them away, the woman did something which made Eddie repent a little of his hard thoughts. Knelt, brushed back the hair of the man in the kilt, and placed a kiss on his dirty cheek.
"Goodbye, Winston," she said. "Wait for me where the tree's clear and the water's sweet. I'll come to you, sure as dawn makes shadows run west."
"I didn't want to kill him," Susanna said. "I want you to know that. But I wanted to die even less."
"Aye."
The face that turned toward Susanna was stern and tearless.
"But if you mean to enter Blaine's cradle, you'll die anyway. And the chances are that you'll die envying poor old Winston. He's cruel, is Blaine. The cruelest of all demons in this cruel, cruel place."
"Come on, Maud," Jeeves said, and helped her up.
"Aye, let's finish with him."
She surveyed Susanna and Eddie again, her eyes stern but somehow confused as well.
"God's curse my eyes that they should ever have happened on you two in the first place. And God's curse the guns ye carry as well, for they were always the springhead of our troubles."
"And with that attitude," Susanna thought, "your troubles are going to last at least 1,000 years, sugar." Maud set a rapid pace along the Street of the Turtle. Jeeves trotted beside her. Eddie, who was pushing Susanna in the wheelchair, was soon panting and struggling to keep up. The palatial buildings which lined their way spread out until they resembled ivy-covered country houses on huge, run-to-riot lawns, and Eddie realized they had entered what had once been a very ritzy neighborhood indeed. Ahead of them, one building loomed above all others. It was a deceptively simple, square construction of white stone blocks, its overhanging roof supported by many pillars. Eddie thought again of the Gladiator movies he'd so enjoyed as a kid. Susanna, educated in more formal schools, was reminded of the Parthenon. Both saw and marveled at the gorgeously sculpted bestiary, bear and turtle, fish and rat, horse and dog, which ringed the top of the building in 2x2 parade, and understood it was the place they had come to find. That uneasy sensation that they were being watched by many eyes, eyes filled equally with hate and wonder, never left them. Thunder boomed as they came in sight of the monorail track. Like the storm, the track came sweeping in from the south, joined the Street of the Turtle, and ran straight on toward the Cradle of Lud. And as they neared it, ancient bodies began to twist and dance in the strengthening wind on either side of them. 22. After they had run for God knew how long, all Jake knew for sure was that the drums had stopped again, Gasher once more yanked him to a stop. This time Jake managed to keep his feet. He had gotten his second wind. Gasher, who would never see 11 again, had not.
"Phew! My old pump's doing nip-up, sweetie."
"Too bad," Jake said unfeelingly, then stumbled backward as Gasher's gnarled hand connected with the side of his face.
"Yarr! He'd cry a bitter tear if I dropped dead right here, wouldn't you? Too likely. But no such luck, my fine young squint. Old Gasher's seen him come and seen him go, and I wasn't born to drop dead at the feet of any little sweet cheeks berry like you."
Jake listened to these incoherencies impassively. He meant to see Gasher dead before the day was over. Gasher might take Jake with him, but Jake no longer cared about that. He dabbed blood from his freshly split lip and looked at it thoughtfully, wondering at how quickly the desire to do murder could invade and conquer the human heart. Gasher observed Jake looking at his bloody fingers and grinned.
"Sap's running, ain't it? Nor will it be the last your old pal Gasher beats out of your young tree unless you look sharp. Unless you look very sharp indeed."
He pointed down at the cobbled surface of the narrow alley they were currently negotiating. There was a rusty manhole cover there, and Jake realized he had seen the words stamped into the steel not long ago. "Le Merc Foundry," they said.
"There's a grip on the side," Gasher said. "You see? Get your hands into that and pull away. Step lively now. Maybe you'll still have all your teeth when you meet up with Tick-Tock."
Jake grasped the steel cover and pulled. He pulled hard, but not quite as hard as he could have done. The maze of streets and alleys through which Gasher had run him was bad, but at least he could see. He couldn't imagine what it might be like in the underworld below the city, where the blackness would preclude even dreams of escape, and he didn't intend to find out unless he absolutely had to. Gasher quickly made it clear to him that he did. "It's too heavy for it," Jake began, and then the pirate seized him by the throat and yanked him upward until they were face to face. The long run through the alleys had brought a thin, sweaty flush to his cheeks and turned the sores eating into his flesh an ugly yellow-purple color. Those which were open exuded thick, infected matter and threads of blood in steady pulses. Jake caught just a whiff of Gasher's thick stench before his wind was cut off by the hand which had encircled his throat.
"Listen, you stupid cull, and listen well, for this is your last warning. You yank that fucking street head off right now, or I'll reach into your mouth and rip the living tongue right out of it. And feel free to bite all you want while I do it, for what I have runs in the blood, and you'll see the first blossoms on your own face before the week's out, if you live that long. Now do you see?"
Jake nodded frantically. Gasher's face was disappearing into deepening folds of gray, and his voice seemed to be coming from a great distance.
"All right."
Gasher shoved him backward. Jake fell in a heap beside the manhole cover, gagging and retching. He finally managed to draw in a deep, whooping breath that burned like liquid fire. He spat out a blood-flecked wad of stuff and almost threw up at the sight of it.
"Now yank back that cover, my heart's delight, and let's have no more natter about it."
Jake crawled over to it, slid his hands into the grip, and this time pulled with all his might. For one terrible moment, he thought he was still not going to be able to budge it. Then he imagined Gasher's fingers reaching into his mouth and seizing his tongue, and found a little extra. There was a dull, spreading agony in his lower back as something gave there, but the circular lid slipped slowly aside, grinding on the cobbles and exposing a grinning crescent of darkness.
"Good, Cully, good," Gasher cried cheerfully. "What a little mule you are! Keep pulling, don't give up now!"
When the crescent had become a half-moon and the pain in Jake's lower back was a white-hot fire, Gasher booted him in the ass, knocking him asprawl.
"Very good," Gasher said, peering in. "Now, Cully, go smartly down the ladder on the side. Mind you don't lose your grip and tumble all the way to the bottom, for those rungs are fearsome, slick, and greasy. There's 20 or so, as I remember. And when you get to the bottom, stand stock still and wait for me. You might feel like running from your old pal, but do you think that would be a good idea?"
"No," Jake said. "I suppose not."
"Very intelligent, old son,"
Gasher's lips spread in his hideous smile, once more revealing his few surviving teeth.
"It's dark down there, and there are 1,000 tunnels going every which way. Your old pal Gasher knows them like the back of his hand, so he does, but you'd be lost in no time. Then there's the rats. Very big and very hungry they are. So you just wait."
"I will."
Gasher regarded him narrowly.
"You speak just like a little triggy, you do, but you're no pube. I'll set my watch and warrant to that. Where are you from, Squint?"
Jake said nothing.
"Bumbler got your tongue, do he? Well, that's all right. Tick-Tock'll get it all out of you, so he will. He's got a way about him, Ticky does. Just naturally wants to make people converse. Once he gets them going, they sometimes talk so fast and scream so loud someone has to hit him over the head to slow him down. Bumblers ain't allowed to hold no one's tongue around the Tick-Tock man, not even fine young triggers like you. Now get the fuck down that ladder. Hup!"
He lashed out with his foot. This time Jake managed to tuck in and dodge the blow. He looked into the half-open manhole, saw the ladder, and started down. He was still chest-high to the alley when a tremendous stone-like crash hammered the air. It came from a mile or more away, but Jake knew what it was without having to be told. A cry of pure misery burst from his lips. A grim smile tugged at the corners of Gasher's mouth.
Your hard-case friend trailed you a little better than you thought he would, didn't he? Not better than I thought, though, Cully, for I got a look at his eyes. Very pert and cunning they were. I thought he'd come out of his juicy little night nudge a right smart if he was to come at all, and so he did. He spied the tripwires, but the fountains got him, so that's all right. Get on, sweet cheeks.
He aimed a kick at Jake's protruding head. Jake ducked it, but one foot slipped on the ladder, bolted to the side of the sewer shaft, and he only saved himself from falling by clutching Gasher's scab-rattled ankle. He looked up, pleading, and saw no softening on that dying, infected face.
"Please," he said,
and heard the word trying to break into a sob. He kept seeing Roland lying crushed beneath the huge fountain. What had Gasher said? If anyone wanted him, they would have to pick him up with a blotter.
"Beg if you want, dear heart. Just don't expect no good to come of it, for mercy stops on this side of the bridge, so it does. Now go down, or I'll kick your bleeding brains right out your bleeding ears."
So Jake went down, and by the time he reached the standing water at the bottom, the urge to cry had passed. He waited, shoulders slumped and head down, for Gasher to descend and lead him to his fate. 23. Roland had come close to tripping the crossed wires which held back the avalanche of junk, but the dangling fountain was absurd, a trap which might have been set by a stupid child. Court had taught them to constantly check all visual quadrants as they moved in enemy territory, and that included above as well as behind and below. "Stop," he told Oi, raising his voice to be heard over the drums.
"Up,"
Oi agreed, then looked ahead and immediately added,
"Fake."
"Yes." The gunslinger took another look up at the suspended marble fountain, then examined the street, looking for the trigger. There were two, he saw. Perhaps their camouflage as cobblestones had once been effective, but that time was long past. Roland bent down, hands on his knees, and spoke into Oi's upturned face. "Going to pick you up for a minute now. Don't fuss, Oi."
"Oi?"
Roland put his arms around the bumbler. At first Oi stiffened and attempted to pull away, and then Roland felt the small animal give in. He wasn't happy about being this close to someone who wasn't Jake, but he clearly intended to put up with it. Roland found himself wondering again just how intelligent Oi was. He carried him up the narrow passage and beneath the hanging fountain of Lud, stepping carefully over the mock cobbles. Once they were safely past, he bent to let Oi go. As he did, the drums stopped.
"Fake,"
Oi said impatiently.
"Fake, fake."
"Yes, but there's a little piece of business to attend to first." He led Oi 15 yards farther down the alley, then bent and picked up a chunk of concrete. He tossed it thoughtfully from hand to hand, and as he did, he heard the sound of a pistol shot from the east. The amplified thump of the drums had buried the sound of Eddie and Susanna's battle with the ragged band of pubes, but he heard this gunshot clearly and smiled. It almost surely meant that the Deans had reached the cradle, and that was the first good news of this day, which already seemed at least a week long. Roland turned and threw the piece of concrete. His aim was as true as it had been when he had thrown at the ancient traffic signal in River Crossing. The missile struck one of the discolored triggers dead center, and one of the rusty cables snapped with a harsh twang. The marble fountain dropped, rolling over as the other cable snubbed it for a moment longer, long enough so that a man with fast reflexes could have cleared the drop zone anyway, Roland reckoned. Then it, too, let go, and the fountain fell like a pink, misshapen stone. Roland dropped behind a pile of rusty steel beams, and Oi jumped nimbly into his lap as the fountain hit the street with a vast, shattery thump. Chunks of pink marble, some as big as carts, flew through the air. Several small chips stung Roland's face. He brushed others out of Oi's fur. He looked over the makeshift barricade. The fountain had cracked in two like a vast plate. We won't be coming back this way, Roland thought. The passageway, narrow to begin with, was now completely blocked. He wondered if Jake had heard the fall of the fountain, and what he had made of it if he had. He didn't waste such speculation on Gasher. Gasher would think he had been crushed to paste, which was exactly what Roland wanted him to think. Would Jake think the same thing? The boy should know better than to believe a gunslinger could be killed by such a simple device. But if Gasher had terrorized him enough, Jake might not be thinking that clearly. Well, it was too late to worry about it now. And if he had it to do over again, he would do exactly the same thing. Dying or not, Gasher had displayed both courage and animal cunning. If he was off his guard now, the trick was worth it. Roland got to his feet. Oi, find Jake.
Jake!
Oi stretched his head forward on his long neck, sniffed around in a semicircle, picked up Jake's scent, and was off again, with Roland running after. 10 minutes later, he came to a stop at a manhole cover in the street, sniffed all the way around it, then looked up at Roland and barked shrilly. The gunslinger dropped to one knee and observed both the confusion of tracks and a wide path of scratches on the cobbles. He thought this particular manhole cover had been moved quite often. His eyes narrowed as he saw the wad of bloody phlegm in a crease between two nearby cobbles. "The bastard keeps hitting him," he murmured. He pulled the manhole cover back, looked down, then untied the rawhide lacings which held his shirt closed. He picked the bumbler up and tucked him into his shirt. Oi bared his teeth, and for a moment Roland felt his claws splayed against the flesh of his chest and belly like small, sharp knives. Then they withdrew, and Oi only peered out of Roland's shirt with his bright eyes, panting like a steam engine. The gunslinger could feel the rapid beat of Oi's heart against his own. He pulled the rawhide lace from the eyelets in his shirt and found another, longer lace in his purse. "I'm going to leash you. I don't like it, and you're going to like it even less, but it's going to be very dark down there." He tied the two lengths of rawhide together and formed one end into a wide loop, which he slipped over Oi's head. He expected Oi to bare his teeth again, perhaps even to nip him, but Oi didn't. He only looked up at Roland with his gold-ringed eyes and barked, "Ake!" again in his impatient voice. Roland put the loose end of his makeshift leash in his mouth, then sat down on the edge of the sewer shaft, if that was what it was. He felt for the top rung of the ladder and found it. He descended slowly and carefully, more aware than ever that he was missing half a hand and that the steel rungs were slimy with oil and some thicker stuff that was probably moss. Oi was a heavy, warm weight between his shirt and belly, panting steadily and harshly. The gold rings in his eyes gleamed like medallions in the dim light. At last the gunslinger's groping foot splashed into the water at the bottom of the shaft. He glanced up briefly at the coin of white light far above him. "This is where it starts getting hard," he thought. The tunnel was warm and dank and smelled like an ancient charnel house. Somewhere nearby, water was dripping hollowly and monotonously. Farther off, Roland could hear the rumble of machinery. He lifted a very grateful Oi out of his shirt and set him down in the shallow water running sluggishly along the sewer tunnel. "Now it's all up to you," he murmured in the bumbler's ear. "To Jake, Oi! To Jake!"
"Jake!"
the bumbler barked, and splashed rapidly off into the darkness, swinging his head from side to side at the end of his long neck like a pendulum. Roland followed with the end of the rawhide leash wrapped around his diminished right hand. 24. The cradle, it was easily big enough to have acquired proper noun status in their minds, stood in the center of a square 5 times larger than the one where they had come upon the blasted statue. And when she got a really good look at it, Susanna realized how old and gray and fundamentally grungy the rest of Lod really was. The cradle was so clean it almost hurt her eyes. No vines overgrew its sides, no graffiti daubed its blinding white walls and steps and columns. The yellow plains dust which had coated everything else was absent here. As they drew closer, Susanna saw why. Streams of water coursed endlessly down the sides of the cradle, issuing from nozzles hidden in the shadows of the copper-sheathed eaves. Interval sprays created by other hidden nozzles wash the steps, turning them into off-and-on waterfalls.
Wow, Eddie said. It makes Grand Central look like a Greyhound station in buttfuck Nebraska.
What a poet you are, dear, Susanna said dryly. The steps surrounded the entire building and rose to a great open lobby. There were no obscuring mats of vegetation here, but Eddie and Susanna found they still couldn't get a good look inside. The shadows thrown by the overhanging roof were too deep. The totems of the beam marched all the way around the building, two by two, but the corners were reserved for creatures Susanna fervently hoped never to meet outside of the occasional nightmare, hideous stone dragons with scaly bodies, clutching, claw-tipped hands, and nasty, peering eyes. Eddie touched her shoulder and pointed higher. Susanna looked and felt her breath come to a stop in her throat. Standing astride the peak of the roof, far above the totems of the beam and the dragonish gargoyles, as if given dominion over them, was a golden warrior at least 60 feet high. A battered cowboy hat was shoved back to reveal his lined and careworn brow. A bandana hung askew on his upper chest, as if it had just been pulled down after serving long, hard duty as a dust muffle. In one upraised fist he held a revolver, in the other what appeared to be an olive branch. Roland of Gilead stood atop the cradle of Lud, dressed in gold. "No," she thought, at last remembering to breathe again, "it's not him. But in another way it is. That man was a gunslinger, and the resemblance between him, who's probably been dead 1,000 years or more, and Roland, is all the truth of content you'll ever need to know." Thunder slammed out of the south. Lightning harried racing clouds across the sky. She wished she had more time to study both the golden statue which stood atop the cradle and the animals which surrounded it. Each of these latter appeared to have words carved upon them, and she had an idea that what was written there might be knowledge worth having. Under these circumstances, however, there was no time to spare. A wide red strip had been painted across the pavement at the point where the Street of the Turtle emptied into the plaza of the cradle. Maud and the fellow Eddie called Jeeves the butler stopped a prudent distance from the red mark.
"This far and no further," Maud told them flatly. "You may take us to our deaths, but each man and woman owes one to the gods anyway, and I'll die on this side of the deadline no matter what. I'll not dare Blaine for outlanders."
"Nor will I," Jeeves said. He had taken off his dusty bowler and was holding it against his naked chest. On his face was an expression of fearful reverence.
"Fine," Susanna said. "Now scat on out of here, both of you."
"Ye'll back shoot us the second we turn from you," Jeeves said in a trembling voice. "I'll take my watch and warrant on it, so will."
Maud shook her head. The blood on her face had dried to a grotesque maroon stippling.
"There never were a back-shooting gunslinger, that much I will say. We only have their word for it that that's what they are."
Maud pointed to the big revolver with the worn sandalwood grip which Susanna held in her hand. Jeeves looked, and after a moment he stretched out his hand to the woman. When Maud took it, Susanna's image of them as dangerous killers collapsed. They looked more like Hansel and Gretel than Bonnie and Clyde, tired, frightened, confused, and lost so long in the woods that they had grown old there. Her hate and fear of them departed. What replaced it was pity and a deep, aching sadness.
"Fare you well, both of you," she said softly. "Walk as you will, and with no fear of harm from me or my man here."
Maud nodded.
"I believe you mean us no harm, and I forgive you for shooting Winston. But listen to me, and listen well. Stay out of the cradle. Whatever reasons you think you have for going in, they're not good enough. To enter Blaine's cradle is death."
"We don't have any choice," Eddie said, and thunder banged overhead again as if in agreement. "Now let me tell you something. I don't know what's underneath Lud and what isn't, but I do know those drums you're so whacked out about are part of a recording, a song. that was made in the world my wife and I came from. He looked at their uncomprehending faces and raised his arms in frustration.
Jesus, pumpkin pie, Christ, don't you get it? You're killing each other over a piece of music that was never even released as a single.
Susanna put her hand on his shoulder and murmured his name. He ignored her for the moment, his eyes flicking from Jeeves to Maud and then back to Jeeves again. You want to see monsters? Take a good look at each other, then. And when you get back to whatever funhouse it is you call home, take a good look at your friends and relatives.
You don't understand, Maud said. Her eyes were dark and somber. But you will. Ah, you will.
Go on now, Susanna said quietly. Talk between us is no good. The words only drop dead. Just go your way and try to remember the faces of your fathers, for I think you lost sight of those faces long ago.